Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Clones, happy freaking hump day, and a hell of a Wednesday it was. Lots of baseball moves, but none bigger than the return of big sexy Bart Colon. Thoughts on that, plus Tom Herman changing the culture at Texas and the truth about one-day contracts, not to mention three awesome guests, Rex Hoggard overseas at the Open, quarterback of the LA Chargers, Philip Rivers, and an entire hour with Ben Mezrich, jungle legend and noted author who brought his new book, Wooly, and the smartest conversation that we've probably ever had in the jungle. It is a must listen. An absolutely amazing day today and a nice tight podcast to get you up to speed. Alvy, go ahead and roll it. Wooly, the true story of the quest to revive one of history's most iconic extinct creatures. This book is out now. Clones, you're going to like this a lot. I'm joined in studio by Ben Mezrich. Ben, it's great to see you. How are you, Ben?
Oh, I'm so psyched to be here. This is my favorite part of my whole book tour, as I was telling you. This is it. This is where it all starts for me.
Yeah, Ben, you always say that, and it seems like a nice thing to say, and it seems like something you might tell somebody else, but
no.
You mean that sincerely, right? What is it about you and the jungle? How has this particular audience resonated with you the way it has
over the years? Well, the clones have essentially propped my entire career up from bringing
come
down
on
the house
now.
On. Every time I come on here, it sells more books than the rest of my tour combined. When I started writing Wooly, one of my first thoughts is talking about it here with you, Jim, because I know that's when people actually start reading it. I'm excited. And this time around, the word clones is actually perfect for this story.
Perfect. It's perfect. All right. So we'll get into that, Ben. I appreciate you saying that about the clones. And I know that's sincere and I know that's from the heart. And they love you too. Now, as the title indicates, it is a book about the quest to revive the woolly mammoth. Now, before we get into that, you get pitched a ton of book ideas, but this is one that you chased down.
Yeah.
So how did you first hear about this idea to bring back the woolly mammoth, and how did you get involved?
Yeah, so I've always been obsessed with woolly mammoths. I don't know if I was a strange kid, but I always thought these are really cool animals, and it's hard to believe they actually existed. And then I started hearing about this story. It takes place in Boston, which is where I live, about this lab that was trying to make a woolly mammoth. And it seems so Jurassic Park and so, you know, out of this world that I had to get involved. So it's the first book that I went and hunted down since bringing down the house, other than the Jim Rome book, which I haven't succeeded in capturing yet. I basically walked into this lab and I asked if I could stay. So I embedded myself and I watched as they are attempting to create a woolly mammoth. And it's about, you know, so much more than just the mammoth. The science that's going on is going to change all of our lives. The fact that you can bring an extinct species. I mean, the mammoth hasn't been around for thousands of years, and there's going to be a baby mammoth soon in Boston. That same science is going to change everything. And so I got really caught up in it, and that's what I've been doing the last year.
Ben Mezrich joining me in studio. The book is called Wooly. We'll talk about how it's going to change or what it could possibly mean to the rest of the world. But let me start with George Church.
Right.
Who is George Church?
Sure. So the main character is this mad scientist, I guess you might call him. He's the Einstein of our times. He's 6'5". He's got a huge white beard and huge white hair. He looks like, you know, what you might imagine God would look like. He's narcoleptic, dyslexic. He grew up single mother in the swamps of Tampa. He couldn't read. And he became the smartest, essentially one of the top scientists in the world. He founded the Human Genome Project. He is working on curing cancer. He's the leading guy in this genetic revolution where we're not just reading DNA. Now we're writing DNA. And this is huge. So he's actually a guy who he's created life in his laboratory. Everyone said that's the line we can't cross. He actually has created a bacteria from scratch already. And the woolly mammoth is one of his new projects where he's going to make mammoths.
Okay, so let's talk about that line that you cannot cross. I mean, one of the obvious issues that he had to wrestle with early on was this notion of whether or not it was ethical to bring back the woolly mammoth.
Right.
What was it that made him feel like it was all right to do it?
Well, the reason to make a woolly mammoth isn't just to make an amusement park like Jurassic Park. The crazy part of this story is there's actually a good purpose to the woolly mammoth. And this is where it gets a little crazy. But it turns out that the whole ring of the world, the whole northern part of our world, is this massive tundra of permafrost across all of Russia, across Canada, across, you know, the whole Arctic Circle. And the permafrost is a giant ticking time bomb. It contains within it more carbon dioxide than if we burned all the forests on Earth three times. So all that stuff we're talking about, you know, recycling and not driving cars and all that crazy stuff, it's meaningless compared to if the permafrost melts. Well, it turns out that these conservationist Russian scientists since the 80s have been running this experiment where they roped off a section of the tundra and they repopulated it with Pleistocene era type animals. So they've got bison, reindeer, Lacutian horses, which are these hairy horses, and they've got this World War II era tank. They've been driving up and down the ice, knocking down trees, mimicking a mammoth. And what they've shown is that you can actually lower the temperature of the permafrost by 15 degrees for a century by just repopulating it with these animals that used to live there. And so
insane.
The goal of the Woolly Mammoth Project is to make a herd of woolly mammoths and release them into the tundra, which is crazy, but it will actually save this part of the world and keep the permafrost from melting.
And then what does that mean ultimately?
Well, it ultimately means that we get another 100 years. It pushes that line back for when, you know, this ticking time bomb might go off. But really, it's this moonshot project. The idea is way crazy, but it's sort of terraforming a big part of our world with mammoths. It's bringing back a creature that we ate. So the reason there's no woolly mammoths is because we ate them out of existence. It wasn't the changing environment that killed them. 12,000 years ago, there were millions of mammoths. We decided they tasted good. We hunted them. One small family of mammoths walked across an ice bridge in the Arctic Circle to an island called Wrangel Island. Then the ice melted. So this family of 500 mammoths at the time lived another 8,000 years. So there were mammoths walking around just 3,000 years ago.
Okay, that was my next point. It has not been that long.
No.
When did they die out?
They were there when we were building pyramids. There were mammoths walking around, and then we got a boat and we went across and we ate them too. So the last mammoth died around 3,000 years ago. And now these mammoths are frozen in the ice. They're coming up out of the ice. Their tusks are worth $250,000 a tusk because this is legal ivory. So even though elephant ivory is illegal, mammoth ivory is perfectly legal.
So the ice melts and there's plenty of them.
Plenty of them. So these same tribes that used to eat the mammoths are now hunting their tusks and are living off their tusks. And it's these guys who are finding the mammoth material and sending it back to labs like George Church's lab so that he can monkey around with the genetics.
Ben Mesrick joining me in studio. The book is called Woolly, The True Story of the Quest to Revive One of History's Most Iconic Extinct Creatures. That book is out right now. I mean, this is absolutely mind-blowing to me. It's insane. So look, what this sounds like to me, Ben, it's your Jurassic Park, all right? So there are obvious parallels to Jurassic Park, but as you've pointed out, that's science fiction.
Right.
That how is cloning dinosaurs from a prehistoric mosquito different from what Church
right.
and others are trying to do?
So Jurassic Park is fiction because you don't actually have any dinosaur DNA. There's no such thing. Dinosaur DNA does not exist. We don't actually know because it's so long ago, millions and millions of years ago. Woolly mammoth DNA does exist. It's coming out of the ice. Some of these mammoths are perfectly preserved. In fact, one baby mammoth has been found when they cut it open, something that looked like red blood came out of it. So the mammoths are coming up. We sequence their DNA, and we're not cloning the mammoth. So Jurassic Park, they were cloning dinosaurs. Cloning is when you take one cell of a creature and you essentially make it reproduce over and over again, and you get the same animal. What we're doing is we're taking the DNA out of a woolly mammoth, we're reading it, and then we're writing it with chemicals in a lab, and then inserting that DNA into the cells of an Asian elephant's embryo. And then an Asian elephant will give birth to a woolly mammoth.
All right, so for instance, how different are woolly mammoths from Asian elephants
right.
that you're talking about that are alive right
well,
now?
Well, they're bigger. I mean, they look different. They're bigger. They've got the red fur. They got these huge tusks. They're about 15% to 20% bigger. They're, you know, 15, 20 feet tall. But in genetics terms, they're very similar. They're almost 99% the same. So if you change, you know, a few hundred genes from an Asian elephant, you're actually going to get a woolly mammoth. George Church is attempting to do 23 genes. So, you know, 23 things that code for red hair, big tusks, the ability to hibernate. Woolly mammoths hibernated, which elephants don't do. And to live in the snow is hard. You know, it's cold. So regular elephants would die in the snow. But woolly mammoths, you know, have to be able to live there. So you've got to make those changes.
Ben Mesrick joining me in studio. Let me do this. I want to open up the telephones. If you want to get into this, he'll stay for another segment. 1-800-636-8686. If you want to talk to Ben about this book or any of his others or his movies, go ahead and do it. Clones. Give me one moment so I can talk to you about Ferguson. Ferguson helps facilities pros by supplying innovative and reliable products, but what Ferguson really offers are solutions. Ferguson has a dedicated team of facilities experts, and with nationwide coverage, we deliver directly to your facility right when you need them. Plus, Ferguson's broad inventory of maintenance, repair, and operations products, along with plumbing, HVAC, and appliances, sets Ferguson apart from traditional facility suppliers. So learn more about how Ferguson Facility Supply can help your facility at Ferguson.com today. That's Ferguson. Now it's back to our Daily Jungle.
I bet another animal that's mentioned in the book is the naked mole rat, which I know the clones will love. A naked mole rat.
Yes. So
is that me or is that you?
I think that's you.
That's pretty embarrassing.
As soon as you said rat, it starts to call. I think the rat situation. So the naked mole rat is this strange little ugly creature. You can look it up. It's one of the ugliest creatures out there.
That is an ugly, ugly animal.
Right. The naked mole rat lives 35 years, while regular rats only live 3 years. So in this lab, they're trying to figure out why that is. They've actually found a possible reason in the genetics of a naked mole rat. They moved it to a regular rat, and now they've got regular rats that live as many as 9 years. So they can triple the lifespan of a rat by using what's in a naked mole rat. And so this same process is going to allow our children to live 150 years. George Church believes our kids will live 150.
Can lead to that or will lead to that?
It will lead to that. Our children will live 150 years. Our children's children may not die. This is what gets really wild. Aging is not normal.
Run that back. My kids that are now 16 and 12 will live to be 150, and their kids will not die.
May not die.
May not die.
So here's the situation. Aging and dying are not natural. You don't get old because it's a natural progress. You get old the same way you get a disease. It's your cells breaking down as they reproduce. That shouldn't happen. The reason it happens is because in each time they copy themselves, a little mistake is made, the edges of them get deteriorated and they fall apart. But for instance, in the naked mole rat, it doesn't happen like it does. In elephants, for instance, elephants don't get cancer. Elephants are huge. They have tons and tons more cells than us. They should get way more cancer than we do, but they don't. So something in their genetics allows their cells to keep dividing without these unnatural processes happening. Once you figure that out, you just slice that little gene out, you stick it into a human cell, and the human cell now has the ability to reproduce without falling apart. So the reason we're doing the woolly mammoth isn't just to make woolly mammoths. It's to get this science to that next level where we can suddenly live a very long time.
Ben Mesrick joining me in studio. If you want to take part in this conversation, if you've got a question about this conversation, hit us up right now. Hit me on Twitter at Jim Rome or call 1-800-636-8686. I don't know, Ben. I mean, what you're saying makes sense to me, but releasing a herd of woolly mammoths, creatures who have not walked the earth in thousands of years, to save the world, no less, not to do it just to do it because it sounds like fun, we got nothing better to do, but to do it to save the world. I mean, it seems like a completely insane concept. Is it?
I mean, it's completely insane and it's true. You know, I feel like Jeff Goldblum's going to be in a movie talking about how life finds a way and the woolly mammoths are going to rampage across Russia. But the reality is this is a project to do good things. It's to use this incredible cutting-edge science. They're going to make 80,000 woolly mammoths. That's the goal. And the goal is to repopulate an area of the world that now has no animals living in it. And it used to be teeming with life. Everyone talks about we're in the sixth extinction. I don't know if you've heard this term.
Sure.
But supposedly, right now, most of our world is going extinct. So many species are dying. Well, actually, we can now bring some of these back. The woolly mammoth is the start of this, but you know, there's this karmic good in this also. We ate the woolly mammoth out of existence. Now we're going to bring him back. If we're going to live in this world that we live in for much longer, we have to find ways to sort of fix the things we keep breaking. And no matter what you believe about the environment, no matter where you sit on the political spectrum, everyone pretty much agrees that getting rid of species is probably a bad thing. It's probably not good that there are no woolly mammoths anymore. And so this is a way to bring them back. And I think it's an outside the box way of solving the environment that, you know, it doesn't make, you don't have to do anything. I don't have to stop, you know, using styrofoam. I don't have to stop driving my car. I just need scientists to go out there and solve these problems. And this is one solution.
Before I open it up to the clones, then the very obvious question, the very obvious follow, is there any concern that bringing back a woolly mammoth is going to have unintended consequences?
Well, there are, of course, many concerns about that. And not that the woolly mammoth is going to rampage in a city, although that would make a great movie. I think people fear a couple things. One is that, you know, you're playing God with something that, you know, the woolly mammoth went extinct. Its time has come. A lot of people say, well, bringing it back is trying to turn back the clock to an era we don't live in anymore. Other people are worried that you're going to endanger the Asian elephant. So the elephants they're using are actually given to them by Ringling Brothers. Ringling Brothers is no longer in existence, so they're giving their elephants to Harvard to use them in the Woolly Mammoth Project. There's a lot of ethical issues, and there's ethical issues in this genetics. I mean, you can create a species. You can also end a species. We could get rid of mosquitoes tomorrow, and a lot of people would think that would be a great idea. You just insert a gene in them that makes them unable to reproduce. And there actually is a project in this same lab they talk about where they're building domed villages in Africa. They're putting domes over villages, and they're releasing special mosquitoes that can't get malaria, can't carry it, but have lots and lots of sex. Mm. And so these sex-starved mosquitoes go out there and they take over the mosquito population and malaria goes away, which sounds like a good thing. But the reason you're using these domes is what if something goes wrong?
Right.
You don't want the mosquitoes escaping and ruining the world. So it's definitely ethically, you know, scary.
Ben, let's get some phone calls in here and see what the clones have to say about this. All right, let's go to Alaska. Brady in Alaska. Brady, you're on with Ben Mesrick.
So
what's up?
This is Brady. Anyhow, Jim, I saw you in Albuquerque on your first tour stop, but I live up here in Alaska now, and I'm wondering if they do release mammoths up in around Nome, Point Hope, Barrow, and all that, what would the impact on the people being up there? I mean, my wife is Alaska Native. We do dig up and find tusks up here and skulls and mammoth teeth. We have several of them at our house, but
wow.
How would that affect the people that actually do live up there?
Interesting. Yeah. Go ahead and answer that question.
So the goal is to release the mammoths first in a habitat there aren't any people.
First of all, Ben, can I jump in? How great is that to get a call from Alaska?
I mean, it's amazing.
Right on point, saying, how's it going to affect us?
A call from someone who's actually got mammoth tusks
right.
in his house.
Right.
You release the mammoths originally in Siberia in an area that there's no people. But then eventually the goal would be across Canada and in Alaska and places like that. You know, the mammoth is not a mean animal. It's not like a dinosaur. The mammoth is much more like an Asian elephant, which is actually a friendly creature. Elephants take care of their children. They even mourn their children. If an elephant baby dies, the mother elephant returns to that spot every year and things like that. So the goal is to not make dangerous creatures. It's to make mammoths that are going to live in their own families in herds. You know, there used to be plenty of mammoths living with people. It wasn't the mammoths killing the people. It was the other way around.
Mm. Ben Mesrick joining us. We go to Tucson this time. Dave in Tucson, you're on with Ben. Dave, how are you?
Good. I'm good. Hi, Jim. Hi, Ben.
Hi. Hey there.
This is fascinating. I'm definitely going to go out and get the book as soon as I'm off the phone. Ben, I've got a two-part question.
Sure.
First of all, what is the time frame of this realistically being able to happen?
Right.
And number two, is the gestation period in an Asian elephant, do they have any idea if the gestation period, when they insert this embryo in an Asian elephant, and if it's going to be the same, or I don't know how they would even know that.
That's awesome. By the way, I bet that's the first time you've ever got that question.
I was just
going to
say, Ben, you know what? Can I just say, I thought that maybe for the clones that the science of this thing might be too much.
Right.
Check it out. I should never underestimate the clones.
No. Good question. First of all, one thing that totally blows my mind is at this moment right now, there are three living prehistoric woolly mammoth genes in a lab in Boston.
Hmm.
Three genes that are alive now in a petri dish that haven't been alive for 12,000 years. The first baby mammoth could come as early as 3 years from today. You're perfectly correct. The one thing keeping it from happening quicker is the gestation period of an elephant is 2 years.
Mm.
They carry their babies for 2 years. So one of the things the lab is working on is a synthetic womb. So you can actually carry a woolly mammoth baby in a lab without having to have it be birthed by the mammoth, by the elephant. If they get to that point, it could happen sooner. But 3 to 5 years is the goal for the first mammoth. Their goal is 80,000 mammoths.
How long will that take?
So the plan is to create a factory where you've got all these synthetic wombs. It's going to look like something out of the Matrix, where you're essentially growing lots of mammoths at the same time. So I would say, you know, 3 to 5 years is when the first one could come to birth. A herd will take probably a half a decade.
Ben Mesrick joins me in studio. His book is called Woolly. It is out right now. We're taking telephone calls. Listen, it's a rare opportunity. Ben usually comes on once, maybe twice a year. If you want to talk to him directly, now is a good time to do it. We'll keep it here in California. Mike in Cali. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Hey, how you guys doing?
Great.
Good. Hey, so I really think it's an interesting idea, but my question is, how do we protect them from being hunted and ultimately to avoid them from becoming extinct again? I mean, I recall the gray rhino.
Right.
They started auctioning off them, you know, as,
right.
you know, part of a hunting Wade so that they can knock him out. How are we going to protect Willie Mammoth again?
It's right. A great question. You know, as soon as you get a Willie Mammoth, there's going to be a bunch of guys with guns hoping to go out and kill it and get it on
looking
their mantle. But the goal is, you know, when you make one Willie Mammoth, you're right. You've taken an extinct species and you've made a super endangered species because you've only got one. You're going to have a protected herd for a while until you get to a point where they're repopulating themselves. They can have babies with each other. I don't think hunting will be an issue in Siberia, and these areas are kind of way out there. I think if it ever got to the point where they were like bison, you would have issues like that. And eventually, you know, I feel like people are much more conscious about things like that. The hunting Asian elephants is not why the Asian elephant is going extinct now. The Asian elephant is really going extinct now because its area is gone. It can't live anywhere anymore. Those jungles don't really exist anymore, and they're dying of diseases. The woolly mammoth will probably be able to live. You know, we're talking about the tundra. It's negative 70 degrees there. I don't think people are going up there hunting very often, and the tribes that are looking for the ivory aren't going to be, you know, hunting the living mammoths.
Let's get another phone call in here quickly before I go to a break. Chris in Detroit. Nice to have you on the show, Chris. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm fascinated. Hello to both of you.
Hi.
My question is this. How does the increased activity of the Pleistocene-type animals and potentially woolly mammoths, how does that preserve the permafrost?
Right.
Intuitively, I would think that the increased activity of the ground would heat it, not
awesome
cool
question.
It.
Such a good question. What does that mean?
You're giving me the best questions I've gotten in my entire book tour.
Say that again?
The best questions I've gotten in my entire book tour. These are the questions that scientists
say. Say it again.
Best questions I've gotten on my entire book tour.
From the clones. It is the smartest half hour of radio I think I've ever done.
Right.
Talk about
so
the
this
permafrost,
is a great question.
The
reason that woolly mammoths lower the temperature of the permafrost is they do a couple things. First, they knock down trees. So the permafrost used to be covered in this low grass. Trees grew there because there's no more mammoths. The trees actually suck in a lot of heat because they're darker and bigger. When they go down and you've got this low grass, it reflects more sunlight, which lowers the temperature. Secondly, the mammoth digs up the snow while it's rooting for food, which actually allows the cold air to touch the ground beneath and make it cooler. And then they pack down the snow. Snow is a really good insulator, and it actually keeps it cold beneath the snow. So there's three processes going on, but it has mostly to do with the reflection of sunlight. Trees actually bring in heat. Getting rid of trees, you know, everyone said you've got to grow trees. The reality is trees are good, but they also bring in more heat than just low grass does.
Let's go to Wisconsin this time. And I love that the calls are coming from all over the country. Brian in Wisconsin. You're on with Ben. Brian, how are you?
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good.
Awesome stuff.
Awesome stuff. I've got a question for you. You say you have the DNA for one woolly mammoth. What happens if you grow two woolly mammoths and they have the same DNA? Are you inbreeding?
So what we've got is once you get the DNA out of woolly mammoth, you can sequence it, which means that you can read it. It's made up of a whole list of letters, A, T, C, G. These are the four letters that represent chemicals in your DNA. Once you've got a DNA sequence, you can copy it. And you can write it in a computer, and the computer can actually print it out in chemicals. It's really, really cool. And so once you've got someone's DNA, you can make as many copies as you want. But they're not exactly the same. They're similar. But what we're doing is you're actually only taking certain number of these genes from the whole DNA. So one DNA strand is like 3 billion pairs of letters. Hmm. You're only going to take a few thousand, you know, to make a gene, essentially, and place those genes into an Asian elephant. So the majority of what you're getting is Asian elephant with a few characteristics of a woolly mammoth. So it looks like a woolly mammoth. It's got the hair. It's got the tusks. But it's also a large part elephant. So it can have sex with other elephants and have babies. It's not like brothers and sisters. It's more like cousins.
Ben Mesrick.
And in Wisconsin, cousins is legal, right? I think. I don't know.
Hey, don't go down to their level, Ben. All right, so that's Wisconsin. Let's go this time to Houston. Nancy in Houston. Hi, Nancy. How are you?
Yes, fine. I'm your biggest fan, Romy, and of course, Ben.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to ask Ben, He mentioned our kids and our kids' kids about extending our lives and perhaps not dying, but how will the Earth's resources support this?
Good question.
I mean, it's a great question, and that's one of the big ethical issues is when you extend aging. And, you know, pretty much most scientists agree that we're going to get to this point of 150 years. It really is going to tax a lot of the resources in the world. It's not going to be initially available to everybody, sadly. It's not going to be that kind of thing. It's going to happen a few labs, and then you're going to have to figure out how it's essentially sold or trademarked or how it's going to work. When we get to the point where we're extending lives a long way towards immortality, if you want to use that word, then it does get really scary. I'm not sure the world can live like that. So those are really good questions that we don't have answers to. I mean, what happens when some private lab outside of Boston figures out how to make people live 200 years? What's the next thing that happens? And that's a great book, by the way, in itself. I'm not sure I have the answer to that question.
Okay, speaking of labs outside of Boston, what about that lab inside of Boston?
Yeah.
What's it like when you walk into that lab?
It's like Willy Wonka's factory. You walk in there at 2 in the morning and there's 91 postdocs. These are these super geeky kids who don't make any money. They live in these crappy apartments in Fenway, and they're just doing science all the time. And in one corner, people are working on these transgenic mice that can't carry Lyme disease. They're going to release 100,000 mutated mice on the island of Nantucket to stop Lyme disease. In another corner, they're working on these crazy neural networks. It's like AI made out of biological material. In another place, they're working on synthetic fuel made from bacteria. I mean, it's like it's crazy in there. Mosquitoes are flying around in this little dome, and they burn $16 million a month in this lab. It's like a factory where anything goes. The only word in it is nothing is impossible. And the other slogan from the lab is, you know, it's only science fiction until we take away the fiction.
$16 million per month?
Yeah, that's
who's,
how much
who's
they
funding
spend.
It?
Well, it getting funded by a lot of different, both government funding, but also private funding. Peter Thiel, the PayPal billionaire, is actually funding the Woolly Mammoth Project because he's obsessed with living forever and reverse aging, and he sees the Woolly Mammoth Project as feeding into that science. The money is also made. They've got companies starting out of that lab. They just started a new company that's making transgenic pigs with livers that humans can use. They've got two baby pigs now who have in them livers that are perfectly compatible with humans. So imagine what that's going to do to the whole transplant world. You're not going to wait for a liver or a kidney anymore. There's going to be a herd of pigs that you can get a human liver out of.
Hmm. Ben Mesrek joining me in studio. Ben, this guy actually has a question that I was going to ask you. And what do you know? Somebody else from Wisconsin. Let's go to Green Bay. Mike in Green Bay. It's good to have you, Mike. You made it in. What's up?
Hey, guys. I apologize if this question was asked before, but have you guys considered using a different species for doing the gestation, such as like Rob or Rex Ryan? I'll hang up now and listen to you.
All right. Actually, on a more serious note, not bad. Not a bad effort. What other species are being... So when I say that this guy's going to ask the question that I was thinking, that was not the question. But what other species are being looked at or worked on?
Right. So they're attempting to de-extinct. One company trying to make a cave lion, which were these like... They're like saber-toothed tigers kind of, but they're kind of bigger. Another company is working on passenger pigeons. So you used to look up in the sky and the whole sky was red with these passenger pigeons. And then at the turn of the century, around 1900, we realized they were good to eat. So we would put giant nets in the air and catch them and eat them. So we eat pretty much everything that lives. So we ate all the passenger pigeons and there's none left. And so one of the people in the book is trying to make passenger pigeons. There's been talk about, you know, all sorts of extinct creatures. You just can't go as far back as the dinosaur. You can only go a couple hundred thousand years back. But beyond that, you're just guessing at the DNA.
All right, we're running out of time. I've got time for maybe one more call or two calls for Ben Mesrek. Once again, the book is called Woolly. Woolly is out right now. Let's go this time to New York. Put them on hold, and then I'll go there. We got it now. Lance in New York. Lance, you're on with Ben Mesrek. Lance, how are you?
Yeah, my question would be, well, it's not really a question, but think about it. If you extrapolate it out, like the last caller said, if we get to a stage where they're saying we can live forever, well, obviously at some point, wouldn't that spell the beginning of mankind's extinction? And I just find it ironic. We're bringing back the woolly mammoth, and couldn't that actually spell out the beginning of the end of mankind?
It's a great question, you know, and these are big issues. I think if we lived forever, obviously we'd have to have less children. And so that would be a difficult, or we'd have to go to other planets.
How do you fix
I mean,
okay.
You need more space.
Right.
The thing is, a lot of the world is not inhabited. We're all jammed into cities, but there's a lot of the world that isn't full of people. It's just, you know, the environment isn't very good. So you have to figure out ways to live in different places. But you're absolutely right. Living forever is not something that, you know, is all good. It's good if you, you know, for a while, but after a while it taxes the world.
Hey Ben, you and I have talked in the past. Generally, and this is not the end all, I mean, critics will do what critics do.
Right.
Generally, what are reviews like of the book? The books sell like crazy.
Yeah.
The movies do great. Generally, what are reviewers saying about your books, and what are they saying this time?
Yeah, Wooly, this is the best reviews I've gotten in my career. NPR did this phenomenally. NPR is usually very too literary for me. They usually, you know, don't go after me. The New York Times has called me I write for people who don't read. but the NPR loved this book and went crazy. And then USA Today said, move over Jurassic Park. You're comes the Woolly Mammoth. And so these reviews have been phenomenal. I mean, I think part of it is that this is about making a scientist cool. And you know, most of us, science is hard. I've never looked in a microscope and never seen anything. And I think that the goal of this book is the scientists are the good guys. If we're going to get out of this world alive, if the world is going to get fixed, it's going to be scientists who save us. You know, as much as we fear what they're doing and we don't understand it, those guys in those labs at 2 a.m. are the ones who are going to solve all our problems.
What about Church himself, though? Is he one of those guys that doesn't want to, obviously not, doesn't want to tell you what he's doing in there?
Right. He's not. So the science is dangerous when it's done in secret. One of the companies I talk about in my book is doing just that. There's a South Korean company trying to make the Woolly Mammoth who have secretly bought up all this land in Alberta, Canada, and the residents there are trying to figure out what he's doing, and they think they're building a Jurassic Park there. They're cloning dogs. You can actually get your dog cloned for $100,000. But these secret labs are what's scary because we don't know what they're doing. George Church is open. He wants everyone to know what he's doing. He's going to do the Woolly Mammoth in public so everyone can see how he did it, because it's science and secret is where it gets dangerous. You know, you're making what could be weapons of mass destruction, the idea of knocking out a gene so that it ends a species. That's scary.
Yeah, but I've mentioned things like Bringing Down the House, The Accidental Billionaires, The 37th Parallel. We've talked about all your books on the program. You might say to me that it's like picking a kid. You're not gonna tell me who your favorite kid is. What about this project? Where does
Wooly
this rank?
Well, Wooly is, you can tell, Wooly is a passion project of mine. I've wanted to be Michael Crichton my whole career. I've wanted my Jurassic Park. And the Woolly Mammoth, you know, the only Woolly Mammoth we've ever seen in a movie pretty much is Ice Age, you know, is Ray Romano in a cartoon. I wanted to do a Woolly Mammoth story that's real, a Jurassic Park that's real, and I found it. And so for me, I think the Woolly story is the most important book I've ever written. And I'm hoping people go out and feel the same way. And, you know, I want to talk to everyone and anyone who wants to talk about Woolly Mammoth. I also think that this is a great book for high school kids to get across the whole idea. The synthetic biology is going to change everything. Our lives are going to be so dramatically different in 10 years. And I'm optimistic about it. We're going to cure diseases. We're going to live longer. We're going to be healthier longer. And we're going to have Woolly Mammoths walking around. I mean, how cool is that?
Where would you like to see them buy this book?
Woolly? Yeah. I want to see Woolly. I love everything.
Where do the clones get the book? Where would you
Amazon,
like to see them?
Amazon and bookstores, Barnes & Noble's and your local bookstore. I know Woolly is doing really well in the independent bookstores, but obviously, like every other author, I watch Amazon and Barnes & Noble's. But buy it wherever you love to buy books. And if you Kindle, whatever you want, just, you know, I would love to hear from you as well. I love responding to the clones because they're funny and they're cool, and I'm one of them. So if you buy Woolly and you like it, shoot me a tweet.
But why don't we start first with the bad news for Houston? The Astros announced all-star shortstop Carlos Correa is going to be out 6 to 8 weeks with a torn ligament in his thumb. Terrible news, and the kind of thing that would derail most teams, but it tells you something about how good that team is and how massive their division lead is, that they can lose an all-star, having a career year, and it's still not time to slam the panic button. Doesn't mean it's a good thing, but when you've got a 16.5 game lead after last night and you've got a super utility player in Marwin Gonzalez, it's not going to derail your season. You never want to see a player like this miss time, but if there's ever a time for Houston to lose an all-star, it's right now. They don't need him in mid-July. They'll need him in October, and they should have him back then. Tuesday also saw a couple of significant trades. Arizona got things started by dealing for J.D. Martinez from Detroit. I love that move. Love that move for Arizona. Totally brass. It's a statement trade. Statement being, they're not just happy to make the postseason. They want to make some noise when they get there. And they have really struggled against left-handed pitching this season. So they go out and they add the best right-handed bat on the trade market. And they'll most likely stick him right behind Paul Goldschmidt in the lineup. Even better than what they got in J.D. Martinez, is that they did not have to give up much to get him. But the Martinez trade was simply an appetizer for the seven-player trade that went down late last night between the Yankees and the White Sox. New York gets Todd Frazier, David Robertson, and Tommy Kahnle in exchange for four prospects. Like the Diamondbacks, the Yankees are looking to address a need with their lack of production at third base and first base. And they hope that Frazier's numbers this year, which aren't great, are more about bad luck than anything else. If nothing else, he gives them some pop. But if you're a Yankee fan, the thing that has to get you really worked up is the fact that a would-be, should-be, nasty bullpen just got nastier. Look, I know, Yankee fan. The bullpen has been a real issue of late. And that those arsonists back there seem hell-bent on burning every stadium that they walk into right into the ground. Also, Yankee fan, I know you pretty much hate Tyler Clippard. Yeah, well, he's gone. And sticking Kahnle and Robertson in front of Dellin Betances and Aroldis Chapman is nasty. It's filthy. And keeping with the model that has worked in the postseason, where bullpens start ending games earlier and earlier and earlier, I like that deal a lot for the Yankees. I like that deal. But the real news from yesterday is the return of Bartolo Colon. Big Sexy is back, which means baseball is back. Big Bart made his debut for the Twins last night against the Yankees. He looked awesome doing it. You knew it was a special night when the stadium DJ was bumping Sexy and I Know It as Big Bart warmed up. Then he goes out and he drops a 1-2-3 inning on the Yankees' heads, including a backwards K of Aaron Judge on a two-seamer that was just awesome. In other words, grab some pine, young fella. Bart's back.
1-2 on Judge. And here's the pitch. He got him. Strike three called. Locked him up in a fastball. So Colon, welcome to Twins territory. A 1-2-3 first inning. Capped off with a strikeout of Aaron Judge.
All right, so sure, his stat line wasn't great. Four innings pitched, eight hits, four earned runs, three strikeouts, an ERA of 9. You know what I have to say about that? Please. First off, would it kill the Twins bullpen to pick my man up? He's out there busting it, laying his heart on the line, and you come in and you can't keep his runners from scoring? Secondly, Bart is not a show horse. He's not coming in here to be a flash in the pan for a game or two. He's in it for the long haul, and so am I. The Diamondbacks made a big move yesterday. The Yankees made an even bigger move, but the biggest move of all was the return of Bartolo Colon. And the Twins, the state of Minnesota, the entire world is better for it. And instead of letting this guy down, you should be doing everything in your power to pick him back up. And when you hit your knees at night, the very first thing that you should be thankful for is the fact that Big Sexy is gracing you with his presence. Now do your freaking job because you know he's going to do his. Come on, Twins. You got to be better than that. He is. Now you need to be. We're joined right now by LA Chargers quarterback Philip Rivers. So let me ask you first, training camp is due to open up in less than 2 weeks. So when it comes to this part of the summer, Philip, are you trying to soak in the last few days or are you just itching to get to camp and get to work?
It's funny you ask. It's about right now every year where my wife, Tiffany, looks at me and goes, every year this time you start to get a little antsy. So that's kind of right where I am. I am enjoying the last few days with family and family time and obviously working out and getting ready. But it's about right now where you start to look at the 29th and start to get excited.
You know, it's almost like the very end of a vacation, or if you've been gone for a week or 2 weeks, it's great when you start, but then by the very end, you're ready to get back to work. As an example, also, I had Matt Ryan on yesterday, and he talked about how much he's changed as a quarterback since he arrived in the league, especially as it relates to preparation. Nick Hardwick, a former teammate of yours, was recently talking about your brain, all the knowledge you've accumulated over the course of your career. So in your opinion, how much of being an NFL quarterback is about physical skills and attributes, and then how much is just about the mental side of the game?
Well, I think it depends what your physical skills and attributes are, how much you have to rely on the mental side of it. Certainly, doesn't hurt to be really good at both. I think it's huge in my position, especially in my skill set. Obviously, I'm not going to run away from anybody. I'm not going to scramble for many first downs. I'm going to be standing in the same spot most every time when I drop back to pass. And obviously, I got to be able to throw it accurately and have the ability and talent from an arm standpoint and moving in the pocket and all those physical attributes. But to me, especially at this point in my career, you don't want to lose that and certainly work hard to maintain that effectiveness physically. But it is mentally. It's mentally preparing week to week. It's figuring out a defense, figuring out what they do. It's really, really knowing your offense better than anybody in the building, so you can make those quick decisions. So I think it's a combination of both, but certainly some guys that are more physically talented can get away with being less from a, not saying from a mental standpoint, but from that, it doesn't weigh as much as it does with a guy like me.
Makes perfect sense to me. Philip Rivers joining us. It makes perfect sense because you're playing a physical game, but you're also, in a sense, playing chess. So how much do you enjoy the chess game? How much do you enjoy recognizing what a defense is doing before they actually do it and then beat them for a first down or a touchdown?
There's really nothing more gratifying. That's the part, and I think I've told you before, the Monday to Saturday part of it, the preparation part of it, figuring out an opponent. They're certainly different, but I almost enjoy more than the Sunday touchdowns and the highlights and things that come with that. It's not apples to apples, so it's hard to say which one you like more, but I truly enjoy that Monday to Saturday, figuring out an opponent. And there are so many times, you mentioned Nick Hardwick and him, among others, where something happened on Sunday afternoon that we either talked about in the meeting, made an adjustment on Saturday morning, something we thought we saw on film, and it comes to, and it's a big third down conversion or a touchdown, or it's a blitz pickup, and it's just that, you know, me look at you and you look at me, and it's that fist pump, like, there's nothing better. You know,
right.
It came to on a Sunday afternoon, all the time and effort we spent trying to figure something out, and that's the part of it that I still have a great passion for, and that's what really gets me excited about having more than just a couple years left, hopefully.
Yeah, Philip, I can hear it. I mean, I can hear your voice. I can hear that passion. I can tell you're fired up. You're ready to go. Hey, have you lost any of that at all? Does it ever wane at all, or is that passion, that energy, that fire always right there?
I don't think I've lost any of it at all. I think it maybe is expressed a little differently now. I mean, shoot, I'm not a 25-year-old kid running around, that was so noted as a trash talker, and this guy, and he's constantly running around. So I think in some ways that's been a little subdued. It's expressed a little differently. I'm certainly not that 25-year-old kid anymore. Should be 36 this December, so it's maybe expressed a little differently. But shoot, I'm a big kid out there that loves to play when it comes to the game, and I think that finally, at least I hope, I know the people that know me do, that it is received that way now. And you know what? Maybe he is just playing like he would in the backyard with his brothers and with his buddies, and that is truly how I put it. And I think now around the league, and at least I know my peers, the guys we compete against, they see it that way. And there's no hard feelings, and there's none of that that used to kind of get hyped up back in my early days.
Los Angeles Chargers quarterback Philip Rivers joining us. Phil, can you explain what it is like to be the face of a franchise and a quarterback? As an example, you just said, I've got to know more about this offense than everybody in this building, which is true, but really it's so much more than that. I mean, do you feel like as the quarterback, and there's so few jobs like that in all of sports, that everybody in that organization, not just in that locker room, but everybody is always looking at you, always looking at what you're saying and what you're doing and leading from the front? And how seriously do you take that responsibility?
Well, I think very seriously, and I think it's a heck of an honor, really, and a heck of a responsibility to have. I know more than any, and I think I'd like to consider myself a heck of a leader. And I think all guys that are leaders, that have been leaders in any, wherever they are and what their profession is,
it's them first understanding it takes everybody. And so I certainly, I never have liked the phrase, oh, it's my team, or I'm the face, you know, but I know that some of that comes with the position. And I think I certainly, I don't boast in that regard, but I also don't try to deny that fact that that's what comes with this position. You've been a quarterback somewhere for going on 14 years. That's kind of how it's going to, how it rolls, you know? And so, you want to be a servant leader, and you want to know that the guys, you're one of the guys. And so I always, have been very, at least try to be very conscious of that and being a teammate. I really love that aspect of being a teammate, but it's a special role. It's a special position. It's one I dreamed about being in. I had all those guys, Marino and Elway and Montana and Aikman and Favre and Manning, and all those guys were on my wall as young kids, and that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be playing NFL quarterback, and I've been able to live out that dream now for over a decade, and I don't take it for granted.
Now, you've been really lucky to play your entire career with one team, but some of the guys you mentioned, Philip, I mean, if it could happen to a guy like Joe Montana, if it could happen to a guy like Brett Favre, I mean, it could almost happen to anybody who's ever played that game, that these guys did not end their careers where they started. Could you ever see a scenario in which you asked to leave the Chargers in order to pursue a Super Bowl ring, or would a ring simply not mean as much if it didn't come with the Chargers?
I can say honestly now I don't ever see a scenario where that would be the case. I certainly don't want to look up in the future and say, without a doubt, I would never wish that or want that. I mean, I just don't think he can make those types of guarantees. But I can say complete honesty now, I don't see that scenario. I do feel like it's very special to play in one place in your career. And like you mentioned, some of my favorite, some of the best to ever play, didn't do that. But, you know, I would love to be able to finish as a Charger and certainly win a championship as a Charger. You know, I was telling my children the other day, they're asking, I was saying, I don't remember if it was year 14 or 15 or 15 or 16 for Elway, but his name came up, and I said, shoot, he played and didn't win a Super Bowl until year 15, and then decided to come back and won it again. You know, they were saying, gosh, that's crazy, because we were just talking, shoot, that's family too, about kind of the home stretch as it approaches. And so I know I gave you a long answer to an easy question, but I the ideal scenario, Jim, is to win a championship as a Charger and finish right there.
It's a good answer. It's a very good answer. Philip Rivers joining me. Before you go, I saw that you recently partnered with Groove Rings. Now, what's a Groove Ring? How did you first get involved, and what do you like about their ring?
Yeah, well, you know, Jim, Groove Ring is a handful of companies now making them. It's that silicone ring, you know, you wear as a wedding band. And, you know, our regular wedding bands, you take off to lift weights, take off to go play in the game, take off to shoot, whether you're doing stuff in the yard and gardening or handling heavy tools and equipment. So this ring you can wear all the time. And Groove Ring is all about commitment. So just like commitment, you want to show to your wife all the time, they're all about commitment. They're lifetime guarantee, warranty. If it were to break or something were to happen, not pleased with it, they send you another one right away. Shoot, they make them all different colors, and they make them where they look sleek. Shoot, it looks just like my regular band almost, and they're breathable. They don't really sweat and bother you. And but shoot, I love them. I wear it when we play and wear it when hanging out with the kids and all the time. So Groove Ring has been awesome.
Yeah, as somebody who lost a wedding band once on a trip, I could tell you it's a good thing to have. It's a good thing to have. You know, Philip, one last thought. You mentioned earlier in the interview that when you do the work and you do the prep and you just see that moment on the field where you can look at a teammate and you just kind of look at each other and you know, and you can shake your fist like, it worked, we executed. Melvin Gordon said recently, like, for as an example, I would imagine you and Antonio Gates have had that moment dozens and dozens of times. Gordon said recently of you and Antonio, quote, it would mean a lot to get those guys that ring before they step down. So what's it mean to hear that from one of your younger teammates?
Well, in all honesty, Jim, it gives me the chills. And I did hear that comment, but it gives me the chills. I think as you get later in your career, shoot, it can even get me a little emotional about it, because I feel so thankful to have been in the same place for so long and really to be able to develop so many relationships with so many people and players. And I feel like we have a great rapport in our locker room with guys from Gates and myself at 36 and 37 years old, with a guy like Melvin Gordon at 24 and Keenan Allen at 23 and Hunter Henry and the young guys. You know, so there's a big gap, and not to get overly sentimental, but you don't have an opportunity to, none of us in that locker room would have ever met if not for this game of football. And, you know, there's not many workplaces where myself at 36 is going to work with a Melvin Gordon, a Keenan Allen, a Jason Verrett, all of us guys that we've come from so many different backgrounds and so many different places in the city, and here we are in that one locker room. And they hear me talk about that a lot, that love that you have for one another and that care for one another. And so it doesn't surprise me to hear that from Melvin after getting to know him the last few years, but it does mean something to you. And I'm glad he feels that way, and I likewise want to win it for guys like that, those young guys that I have a chance to help them attain that, because I know how hard it is. So we made that first AFC Championship game 2007 season when we were all banged up and hurt and didn't get it done against New England that year. And I remember thinking, shoot, and North Turner even told me, he's like, hey, we'll be in a bunch of these championship games. And we haven't been in one since, you know, because you just never know how hard it is to do. So I feel like we are on the same page. We have a close locker room, a close, unique brotherhood. And that part of it may be more important and more exciting to me going into each year than anything. Yes, it's about the wins and losses, but the people you get to share it with and be around every day, we got a good group.
Texas head coach Tom Herman took the podium at Big 12 Media Day yesterday, and Tom Herman did what Tom Herman does. He rocked it. Of course, he talked about quarterbacks, and he made it very clear that he wants to get Texas A&M back on his schedule. But the biggest thing that he talked about was losing, something Texas has done too much of lately, and he wants to change that. Quote, losing has to be awful, and you can never get used to losing. That is one of the biggest downfalls of a lot of teams, is you get used to losing. End quote. Sounds like coach speak, right? Who hasn't taken a job and said something like that? This guy's different. My man's got a blueprint. And I'm not saying it's going to work there because it worked in Houston. I'm saying, though, that it is going to work. When everybody was coming for Mac Brown, I would always defend him by saying it's not a question of if, it's a matter of when. And then Mac got his, just like he said he would. And write this down, Herman's going to get his as well. Again, not a question of if, but a matter of when. Rex, it's good to have you back in the jungle. How are you?
It actually feels like an open championship, finally. It's felt like San Diego for 3 days, Jim. So it's raining, the wind's blowing, so we finally feel like the open has arrived.
Hey, Rex, you know I'm going there next, but first things first, you might very well be the first guest in show history live from Southport, England. How is life treating you these days?
This is a great place, and I think I was thinking about this today. If you go through all of the open venues, this is probably the easiest one just from logistics. There's restaurant. It's a resort town. I mean, this is where the folks in England come to go to the beach, and there's tons of restaurants. But the more important thing, I'm literally standing outside of a Ladbrokes betting house right now. So that's always the best part of it.
That's a good thing. All right, so now you talked about the weather. Play was suspended today at Will Brookdale due to a storm. What's the weather like right now?
Well, the rain finally arrived. They've been forecasting it for quite a while, and it's been absolutely perfect for the last 3 or 4 days as guys have gotten ready. And it's going to be interesting tomorrow morning because the sun was shining. There was very little wind. What wind there was for practice rounds, it was coming from what's going to end up being the opposite direction of what they face come Thursday. So all of that practice, all the lines you picked, all of the landing areas you kind of assumed were going to be safe is going to change. So I think what we're going to see early tomorrow morning and throughout the day tomorrow will be guys sort of scrambling, trying to catch up, trying to figure out exactly how to play this golf course. And if the forecast holds, which is not surprising, it's for more wind, it's for a little bit more rain, but the wind's going to be the bigger factor, I think we're going to end up with a very similar scenario to what we had in 08, the last time the Open was here. And the scoring average on round one in 08 was 75.8. That was the hardest on tour that year. And it's going to be a demanding test.
Retiring athletes never want to hear this, but it's something that they do need to hear. Paul Pierce, as an example, went through that retirement car wash yesterday. Sign a one-day contract, shoot some hoops, crack wise, and then officially retire where he started as a Boston Celtic. Wait, what? Didn't want to suit up one last time for the Brooklyn Nets? What? No love for your time with the Wizards? Look, you call yourself the truth, but the real truth is you already retired as a Clipper. Trust me, we all watched the last 2 years. The one-day contract is not fooling anybody. You went out as a Clipper, just like Emmett went out as a Cardinal, just like Jerry Rice went out as a Seahawk, like Shaq went out as a Sun, or a Cav, or a Celtic, or a member of the Magic, or the Heat. I mean, damn, Shaq, how does a guy who's as good as you bounce around as many times as you did at the end of your career? I get that a lot of you athletes want to be remembered a certain way with a certain team, and you want to go out with who you want to go out with, but you don't get to choose. But whatever works for you, Paul, and Toronto Raptor great Hakeem Olajuwon, and famed Allen Wrangler Terrell Owens, congratulate you on ending your career where it started. Iray Craig is on the train. Iray, I've got a feeling I know exactly what you're doing and where you're headed. What's going on, Iray?
Romy, I'm the guy that Johnny Cash was singing about when he said, there's probably some folks sitting in a fancy dining car drinking JD whiskey and smoking green cigars, brother. I am rolling down to where the turf meets the surf for a big day at Del Mar. And let me tell you, it's a beautiful thing, man. And congratulations on your anniversary there, Romy. Janet is a great gal.
I appreciate that, Irene. I know you know Janet because you used to see her at the tour stops. All right, bro, now talk to me about this. Believe it or not, I have never been to Del Mar opening day because it's always the middle of the week. So for those, and people are tweeting me about it, for those who have not been to that show, what's it like?
Yeah, well, even by my standards where it's a new high and low every week, Romy, it's off the charts, raging. It's just savage beauties and liquored up gambling fools like myself. And it's just a great day, man. It's the sun's out, you know, the horses are beautiful, and hopefully I'll have some cabbage in my pocket at the end of the day instead of having a rabbit between my legs, you know what I mean, with my empty pockets hanging out each side. But either way, it's all good. And speaking of all good, Romy, I'll throw in a little RSVP for the smack off here. I'll be there one way or another. And, dude, how about the Dodgers, Romy? I got to say, brother, in the 25 years, I've been with you longer than you've been with Janet. Think about that. Is that sick? And this has to be a high watermark, brother, for the Dodgers. And I think I'm praying that we finally get that World Series victory this year, dude. You think the Del Mar opening day is a party? If that happens, it's going to be off the Richter scale party time.
Thank you so much for listening. See you right back here on Thursday for another Daily Jungle. And if you haven't left a review yet, it would be great if you did so. And if you haven't subscribed yet, make sure you do that too. We'll see you next time. We are out.